Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, August 1st, day number 213 of 2013. I almost said 2012, but 2013. And tonight we're going to be chatting with Leslie Eastman. She's going to be joining us in a minute. We're going to go over some politics and some general events around the world for a while. And then we're going to bring in author Bruce Woodhull, who has a very interesting book called Wild Indians. I think that is the name of the book, and we're going to be chatting with him about his book. But we begin tonight saying hello to a new friend of the show, and that is Ed Carwell of Ranger Self Defense. Ed, let me say hello. I know you've got beautiful weather in your part of the country. Let me make sure that you're on. There you are. I'm sorry, we had to get you on the air there. But I know you've got beautiful weather in your part of the country, because we have 100 degrees in Texas. So you know, I'm sure wherever you are, you must be better than mine.
Yeah. I'm in Northern Washington, up in Bellingham, and it's probably 68 to 70 degrees right now, and enough cloud cover overhead to keep us from sweltering.
Yes, and that is the beauty of your part of the, you know, your part of the world. You know, the temperatures just absolutely lovely. Well, you have a company called Ranger Self Defense, and this is an online company, and you've been doing this for a while, and I wanted you to share with our listeners a little bit about the company and some of the services and products that you offer.
Well, I have an online retail store for self-defense products like pepper spray and stun guns, where you can conveniently buy those items and have them shipped to you discreetly and have a full 90-day money-back guarantee on those items. They include things like pepper spray, stun guns, do-it-yourself home security equipment, and among many, many other items.
And how can people order them? You have a website, I know.
Yes. Yeah, as you go through the website, you can add things to your shopping cart, just like Amazon.com, and then you end up with a shopping cart. Then you can pay with PayPal, or credit cards are accepted.
Give me an example of some of the services or some of the programs that you have, or some of the products that you have.
Yeah. Well, we have many pepper sprays. Probably 50 or 60 different ones, and they come in different sizes, half-ounce keychains, 2-ounce, 4-ounce, 9-ounce, and even 1-pound canisters of pepper sprays. And I have everybody that purchases a pepper spray, I send a book on self-defense sprays, the tactical use of them for self-defense situations like defending your home and defending in case you're attacked in different ways. With a knife or a gun, or to prevent date rape. That's one of the main services products we sell. We sell also many DVDs that would train you to make self-defense moves of a wide variety of sorts, combative training DVDs that you can get and for training yourself in for self-defense situations.
Self-defense. We have a link to Ranger Self-Defense in the show information. But one thing you were telling me the last time we chatted is that many women use these products, because, of course, women are often vulnerable when they're walking in a parking lot at night or something, and many women can use these products for their self-defense.
Oh, absolutely. These are conveniently things you can conveniently carry in your purse and use in the event of an unfortunate attack. Stun guns are very easy to conceal in your purse. We also have stun batons and stun flashlights for security situations, monitoring your business property or home. Stun flashlights are a very nice thing to have for home defense, an additional piece of home defense equipment in addition to your firearms.
Absolutely. So we're going to recommend to everyone to check out Ranger Self Defense. This is a company that I think can give you the kinds of products that you need to protect yourself in this crazy world. You know, we do have the right of self-defense, and that's one of the things that you can get through your company, Ed. So thank you very much for joining us tonight. Thank you for taking the time, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow. So I guess in about 24 hours, we'll be chatting again.
Thank you for inviting me on the show, Silvio.
All right, my pleasure. Ranger Self
Defense.
Hello,
everybody.
Check
this
it out.
This is Aaron Clary, a.k.a. Captain Capitalism.
Oops, I hit the wrong one, folks. Forgive me for that. I hit the wrong button. I wanted to hit this one right here. So thank you, Ed. Thank you for joining us. And we've got Leslie
sure.
Eastman on the other side, and she's got a great bunch of things she wants to talk about tonight. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let me bring my fingers are really out of put some serenity into my life tonight. Leslie, did I miss you? Are you with me?
No, you faded in and out. I hope we're not having a technical glitch, but I'm hearing you now and really excited to be here for another Thursday night.
Thank you so much. It's always a great honor to have you tonight. We're going to be you and I are going to do a little commentary on the news and look back at some events in world history. And then in the second half, we're going to be joined by a very interesting author, Bruce Woodhull. Just take a second and tell us about him.
Well, Bruce Woodhull is a longtime internet friend of mine. I have been essentially doing conservative based punditry since about 2002. And I was on a conservative site where I interacted with a bunch of very savvy, like-minded, independent conservative people. And Bruce was among them. And through the years, we reconnected on Facebook, and I came to discover he had authored not one but two books all about a fascinating subject that I thought your listeners might particularly enjoy, the mafia, and taking a look at the mafia through the 1960s from a decidedly Midwest perspective. So his books are really gripping, and I thought the opportunity to share audience a little bit about the background and Bruce's experiences and learn a little something about, the mafia, because it seems our government is utilizing similar tactics. So, best to get educated.
That's right. So we'll be listening. We'll be hearing from Bruce in the second half of our program tonight. But let's get into some current events, and I wanted to actually get started by going back in history. Leslie, you and I are big fans of history, and on this day in 1498, that's a long time ago to say the least, but Columbus landed in South America 6 years before he had landed in the New World. But on a day like this in 1498, he landed in South America in what we now call Venezuela. He landed in that island right there in front of Venezuela. He named it Isla Santa, which means sainted or saint island. And, of course, he claimed it for Spain. But what I find fascinating about this man and in reading about his background is, number one, Leslie, and we talked about this one time, his dependence on Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, you know, how much he came to depend on them, and they very much became his patrons. But what I think it's really sad is that this is a man who probably had the biggest discovery in the history of the world, but when he died, he didn't know that he had discovered the New World. I just find that interesting that he died not realizing that he had actually discovered a new world. So I just find that fascinating, Leslie.
Yeah, he's a very interesting man. And you know, I don't think people appreciate that at that time, the dimensions of the discovery were such that Isabel and Ferdinand were sponsoring trips over there, you know, still in quest that straight to India. And there's a real and profound reason for that. Years earlier, Constantinople, which has become Istanbul, was taken over by the Muslims. We talked about in the Crusades period, which effectively eliminated that route of trade with Asia. And it was going to be the savvy country in Western Europe to go ahead and find an alternative route. The Portuguese went ahead and sailed around Africa, and that worked for a bit, but sailing around the Horn of Africa presented enormous challenges. So the thinking was, or to sail around the world, because at that time they had begun, a lot of people knew that the earth was round, but they thought it was a lot smaller than it was. So Columbus, being educated at the time, thought that he had really located, he was very close to India and had no appreciation. He had two massive continents. But also another thing I particularly enjoy is that Columbus got essentially marooned on an island off of Hispaniola on one of his voyages of exploration over there, and had to arrange for a couple of his crew to sail back to Hispaniola and get aboard a ship and save his hide and the rest of the people who were stranded on that island. And, you know, in November of 1504, he returned back to Spain for the last time. And that was, you know, just about 3 weeks after Queen Isabella died. And essentially his star faded away. And only it was in the following century some people began to really explore that region and you know, extract the wealth out of South America, and again, the more profound opportunities in North America, that the magnitude of his discovery was appreciated.
Exactly, but he died not realizing, and that's the sad part, I guess, he died not realizing what he had discovered. I just find it fascinating about this man's life, and one of these days I'm going to have to read a biography, because I know so many parts of his life story, but I've never actually read a Columbus biography. But here's an interesting detail that I picked up while watching a documentary one time about Cuba. It was rumored for many, many, for about 200 years, that his remains had actually been moved to Cuba, and that they were in Cuba, since Cuba was the last Spanish colony to be freed after the Spanish-American War, that his remains were supposed to be in a church in Cuba, and then they were sent back to Spain. Nobody could ever prove that, but that was that's what everybody believed, that there was a very famous church in Cuba where his remains had been moved to. And of course, you know, that's such a long time ago, who really knows? But I just think this man is such a mystery that we didn't even know where his remains were. I guess it's just all part of the Christopher Columbus story. But on this day in 1498, he landed in what we now call South America, specifically what we now call Venezuela. But we're going to get into a lot of other topics tonight, Leslie. But we did one time, just very briefly, we did a show, if you remember, on the famous couples in world history. And Ferdinand and Isabella were one of the couples we talked about. Remember that?
Yes, vividly. It was a great show, and definitely they are an intriguing couple, and they definitely made a major impact on the world through funding Columbus's trip, and it just shows you the importance of networking.
That's right. But it also no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. But I think that maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think Isabella was a little bit more interested in the discovery than Ferdinand. It seemed like she was really the one that was persuaded by Columbus. I'm not sure that Ferdinand would have done it without Isabella. That's just a theory, but it sure sounds to me like that.
You know, if there's a way for a woman to find a new source of income, she's going to push the men out the door to do it. Yeah, that was Isabella.
Well, that was exactly right. Well, she did it. She did it, and she made her country a very powerful, and at the time became the world's superpower, Spain. But we've got some other issues that we're going to get into tonight before we bring in our guest in the second segment. But I want to begin, Leslie, with presidential vacations. I have a post that will appear tomorrow at the American Thinker. Well, I'm really criticizing President Obama for taking another one of these very expensive vacations. And I don't really care that he takes a vacation, but it seems to me with the state of the country, with the state of the country's finances, with many families downsizing their vacations for economic reasons, that the idea that the presidential family, that the first family would spend all this money, it just isn't good optics, as they like to say, Leslie.
Well, you know, one thing I hang my hat on to is that he has a limited time in office. So every day I get, you know, a little disheartened that President Obama is spending our money frivolously and pushing his agenda. I just know that the end is coming, and I don't, you know, we will have another president in a relatively short span of time. In the history of the planet, it's just a drop, so I hang on to that. But that being said, I think where this is important is it sets the tone for the rest of the country, especially in terms of the bureaucracy. How many episodes have we seen of IRS high-level officials or other, you know, DEA, other, you know, bureaucrats who have taken luxury vacations, conferences in Vegas, conferences throughout other premier resort spots in this country on the taxpayer dime. So President Obama is setting the tone, which gives permission for the rest of the Washington, D.C. power structure to do the same thing. And that's what I have a problem with.
Uh-oh. He sets the tone. He always leads by example. And in this particular case, what I think bothers me more than anything else is that I think he would gain points with a lot of people, even people like me who didn't vote for him. He would gain points by saying, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to do something else. Maybe we're going to take a more frugal vacation. Maybe we're not going to go on vacation. We'll just go to Camp David. I mean, that's a pretty nice place, Camp David. And just set the example, Leslie. I think that's what we're talking about. When you're running these deficits, when you're closing the White House tours.
And Sylvia, may I ask you why you would think he would do this? He ran for re-election doing exactly what he's now doing. We have to stop wondering if Obama is going to change for us. He is not. I think what we need to do is focus on getting people in Washington in the next election cycle who will put a stifle on what Obama wants to achieve. And one of the things I wanted to mention briefly is I sincerely believe Obama is a smart man and has targeted, you know, profound changes in our country. And he recently made a remark that he wanted to tax small businesses at a rate of about 40% versus big businesses down 28%. And, you know, you might think that seems almost sensible because let's promote big business. However, it is big business in a lot of ways that funds Democrats, that has the connections into the Washington, D.C. power structure, where it's small businesses, which are conservative-led, which fund conservative causes that, among other things, are a large part of our Tea Party groups. And to tax them is to take away the money that empowers them to fight different choices. So, again, yeah, you know, we could expect Obama to change because it's sensible, but his sensibilities are not ours. And we need to understand that we are going to have to push back on his agenda. And the best way to do it is to go small scale and to make sure we get representatives in Washington who are looking out for our interests, because Obama's not going to change.
No, you're exactly right. And there was a very interesting editorial in the Wall Street Journal today, which I would recommend to all of our listeners, talking about the way Obama is using executive powers, you know, executive decrees, executive orders, and basically governing that way, which is not the way the founding fathers had designed it, but that's what he's doing. And I agree with you, the only way we're going to stop this man is frankly by in the 2014 elections, by electing people that will stop him, by simply having the numbers to do it. Well, I want to get into a couple of other topics, Leslie, briefly with you, as our time flies and our guest will be joining us in a few minutes. But anything from college and insurrection that you want to share with us tonight? We should tell the audience, of course, that you are you are someone who writes at College Insurrection.
Yeah, it's part of William Jacobson, A Legal Insurrection. His website to get information about what's happening on college campuses, which have been taken over by progressive ideology. And one of the topics I've just written about, and I want to start drawing the attention to people, is changes in Title IX implementation of what constitutes sexual harassment on campuses. This is going to make sexual harassment basically asking a girl out on a date or doing something very minor, and having colleges set up in a way that they are going to be able to accuse and convict through college boards young men who are not acting inappropriately in a normal sense of the word. And there's a case in Vassar dealing with a young Chinese man, basically a few drinks. Something happened, but the girl in question did not report it for a year. Not only did she fail to report it for a year, when she did, it took 2 weeks for him to, you know, be convicted of these charges and then kicked out and expelled the school. And what's important to note is that she was a daughter of a Vassar official, and he was tried by three other Vassar officials on this particular board. So it's a war on men on campus, which ties into a lot of what I'm writing about how the college campus has become a very toxic environment to our young men. And this is going to, you know, direct young American men into different areas, into different paths, into different careers, and ultimately impact us down the road.
Exactly. And you have a young son yourself who will be going to college probably in about 10 years or so, maybe less. And I think you, as the mother of a son, I'm sure there's a lot of women who share your thoughts about the way our sons are being targeted by this politically correct crowd.
Yeah, and I think targeted is correct. You know, in the quest to make things fair and equal, you know, they have put a bullseye on men. And it's just not white men. It's black and Latino and other men, because men are considered, you know, the thugs and cavemen who are going to dominate women, and our society is evolving into a girls' club. And, you know, this will impact the choices young men make as they refuse to get involved. Helen Smith wrote a wonderful book, and I encourage everybody to read it, called Men on Strike, about the choices men will make, because when they get married now and when they get kids, they're not rewarded for taking responsibility. They are punished. So they are falling out of the traditional American cultural system of how we expected our society to behave. And this cannot be good for our country in the long term, or the rest of you know, the civilized world. So,
well, that's right.
Really,
well, it's not good for young women either. Because
no, it really isn't, because they have to do everything on their own. And yes, it sounds good in theory, but you try and have a full-time job, take care of all the bills, take care of all the chores, raise the kid with no partner to do it. It's very difficult.
And it is very difficult. Yeah.
And not a choice people, I mean, certainly it does happen, but why choose that intentionally? And why choose a path that eliminates men from the lives of young boys?
That's a real problem. And you and Leslie, you see that in what's happening in the inner cities with the number of boys growing up without fathers, let's say in the black communities, and you know the impact that that's having on these young boys who are growing up without good role models, male role models. So but I think that, you know, the word target is exactly the right one. They're targeting men, and because they, you know, they associate men with whatever, and I think they're doing a lot of harm to our society in the college campuses. Very quickly, before we move on to our next segment, we're also going to be hearing from Aaron Clary here in a couple of minutes. Anything new from San Diego, Leslie? San Diego is all of a sudden,
you know,
getting
something?
A lot of publicity.
I mentioned, you know, the corrosion of culture in San Diego. Mayor probably is the poster boy for the corrosion of culture. This is a man that women can fairly target as being a male chauvinist pig in the very classic sense of the word. Mayor Bob Filner, 8 women have claimed sexual harassment charges on him, and there have been a lot of developments. But perhaps the most, I'll say, amusing in terms of just the audacity of grope, as I referred to it, is that Filner is claiming that the city needs to pay his legal expenses because he didn't receive the necessary sexual harassment prevention training. So how could he expect it to be understand what sexual harassment was in the workplace unless he received this training? So,
that is the audacity of whatever you called it. That is amazing.
Grope.
Yeah, that is amazing, Leslie. That is remarkable. But you certainly, I mean, in a weird sort of way, he has put San Diego on the map a little bit here in the last week. Not in a way I'm sure that the citizens of San Diego would prefer, but everybody's talking about him.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this, I'm going to be writing about this in the next little bit. Why does this matter? You know, the women didn't get hurt. It matters because, first, our media knew about it and didn't report it. So, second, our voters were not able to make a fully informed choice. Third, this is the kind of power, you know, attitude that Filner has that influences every single decision related to our city. For example, he just took a junket to Paris, France, gave a 3-minute speech, and charged the city $10,000 in travel expenses, and claimed that the group he was talking for was a nonprofit when it clearly was not. So the use of power against women is the use of power against all citizens. And I'm certain that the good people of San Diego, had they been fully informed about Bob Filner, would have made a different choice in November. That's why this is important.
That's right. And that's why many of us are calling for his resignation. Let me say hello to Aaron Clary, who's joining us tonight. Aaron Clary, of course, Captain Capitalism. Now, tell me something, Aaron. Where are you calling us from tonight? You back home or are you still riding all over Canada?
I'm back home. Got back about a week ago. So I am back in Minneapolis.
All right. Now, what are you just give us a quick explanation of your trip.
Well, I was going to do the Canadian Rockies, take a 2-week trip, rented a cruiser bike because I got a crotch rocket at home, and that is not designed for long-distance riding. So I rented a cruiser bike for about 2 weeks, and then I recalibrated, you know, using Google Maps and everything. I said, well, I can make it to Canada or Alaska if I wanted to. So I went out to Calgary, enjoyed the Stampede, which is kind of their Sturgis celebration of sorts. And then I made a rocket run out to Hyder, Alaska, and, you know, took some pictures and literally turned around, started heading back, and then headed south through the western United States. So that was the trip that I intended there.
How many miles did you drive?
5,300 miles in 10 days.
My goodness, that is a lot of traveling, Leslie. That is a lot. And you did this in your bike?
Well, not my bike, but a rented bike, yes. It was a Honda Shadow 750. So got some saddlebags, and it was actually quite comfortable because the my tote bag that I strapped to the passenger seat that sits right behind the driver's seat, it actually ended up becoming a backstop. So it was almost like riding a recliner a little bit.
Wow. Well, Captain Capitalism is also the author of a couple of great books. And Worthless is the book that I like to take a second tonight, Aaron, and talk a little bit about, because there's almost on a daily basis, there are reports out of our universities, and I send you copies, and I send Leslie a copy, because I know both of you are very interested in this. But it just seems like every single day there's news coming out of higher education about all the problems they're having, the cost of a diploma, and how more and more kids are deciding not to go to college, or at least maybe go in a different way. There's now talk about online courses. So your reaction to all of this, you know, you really got something started with that book.
Right. Yeah. And it's a testament to when the mainstream media finally admits there might be a problem. I mean, that's like, it's kind of like an old person finally deciding to get rid of a voice recorder for their phone and getting a cell phone. So now that the mainstream media is finally catching on, it's official now. But yeah, this bubble is bursting as we speak. It's exploding. It's akin to the housing bubble in 2007. And as you pointed out, I mean, even these young kids are starting to get it, because what we're asking for is so ludicrous of these young kids that they're waking up. What, I got to spend $100,000 on a degree that's not going to get me this? And I think what a lot of it is also is a lot of these younger kids, they have older brothers or sisters or siblings that are going through. They're like, whoa, it's like watching the quarterback get sacked. They say, I don't want to do that. So, yes, this bubble is bursting. It's finally coming to the forefront. You even have, you know, people that are usually in cahoots with big education and leftist socialist type entities like the New York Times and Newsweek. They're even, you know, Yahoo News is even running, arguably, as you pointed out, like almost a daily feature of these poor kids running into the bursting of the education bubble.
No, I think of you every single day, and I send you a copy, and Leslie, you get them also, and I send you guys copies because this is happening every day. This is being reported every day, and it is really, I think, an awakening, whether it's you know, the news media, however it's happening, and more people are finding out the problems with higher education. Now, you can get your books at Amazon, you can get it Kindle, and you can get them also on print. So, or you can also go to your website, Captain Capitalism, and get them right there. So, any other way of getting the book?
Yeah, a buddy of mine, Davis Arini, he has a website called staresattheworld.com. He did the voice for the audio version of Worthless. So, Worthless is also now available at audible.com or amazon.com. The best way to go is just go to Amazon, search my name. You'll find all the books in all their various formats, be it paperback, Kindle, or audio.
Excellent, Aaron. Well, thank you so much
Hello,
for joining us tonight.
This is Aaron Cleary, a.k.a.
Oops,
Captain
I got
Capitalism.
The wrong one. For some reason, I'm hitting the wrong file tonight. I don't know what the heck is wrong with my fingers, but
hey,
but
Aaron,
I wanted
to thank you before you went for the link this week. I saw a spike on my page views and knew that you had showed me a little link love. Much appreciated, my friend.
Well, we just love you in general, but since you're way far away over there, I can't hug you, so all I can do is send you some traffic.
Yeah, sometimes that is all I need, but I'll cross my fingers and hope today, someday in the future and soon I'll be able to meet you and you can give me a ride on the back of your bike. That would be awesome.
All right, wonderful. I will do.
All right. Well, this time I think I've got the right file. Yes, I do. Well, good night, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good night, guys.
All right. We're going to bring in our next guest, our special guest tonight, and that's Bruce Woodhull, the author of the book Wild Indians, and he'll be with us in a second. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, having a few problems with our music files tonight, but I think we finally got it all squared away. Let me have Leslie introduce our wonderful guest. So take it, Leslie.
I would like to give a warm welcome to Bruce Woodall, the author of at least two books, Omaha in the Time of Saints and Wild Indians, and he's a longtime friend, you know, his own independent conservative-minded buddy from ages back. I hate to think about how long we've known each other, and a warm welcome to you, Bruce. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you, Leslie. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you great. Yeah, we can hear you great, Bruce. It's a great honor to meet you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be on your radio show.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to have Leslie ask you a couple of questions. But the question I always ask first is if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, right now I live in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And I'm from Nebraska originally. And like Leslie says, I'm kind of conservative in my thoughts. I've been a writer for a while and produced a couple books. And so, you know, I'm glad to be on your show. It sounds like a good show.
Thank you so much. But Leslie, take it away.
Well, I'd like to invite everybody after the show to check out Amazon.com. There are links on my website and on Facebook to Omaha in the Time of Saints and Wild Indians. And both of these books have as a theme the mafia in the 1960s. And for us who are Catholic in Silvio's vast audience, which includes many of us, I've got an extra Vatican bonus in there. So I'd like Bruce to tell us a little bit about what inspired him to write these books and a little bit about Omaha, which apparently is the first book in this series.
Well, what inspired me is that, you know, I have a passion for writing. You know, you say you would do the thing that you love most, even if you can do it for free. Well, that's what I'm doing right now. Basically, I'm doing it for free till the book starts selling. Anyway, growing up in Omaha, there was always the stories about how the Omaha mob ran things, and it was kind of apparent growing up. There was the Falstaff Brewery. There was the Omaha Stockyards, which at the time were the largest in the world. Yeah, a number of operations going on there, the gambling. When I was a little kid, I used to take the bus downtown and hustle drinks in the basement of the Foxhole Bar where they had illegal prize fighting. You know, you get like a dime to a dollar for getting these wise guys their drinks. It was a great time to grow up, great place to grow up, you know. But there's the dark side of it, too. We all know that, but what government doesn't have a dark side?
True enough, and if it didn't, we would not be chatting, and we would not have met each other either, because we went back and forth for many years on all the fun related to the Bush administration. But that being said, you know, The Godfather, both the Mario Puzo's book and the subsequent movies, was really popular in this country. In your opinion, what makes the mafia such an intriguing subject for authors such as yourself?
I believe that the thing that I see in it, a lot of Americans see in it, is that you have a group of guys, in this case these are going to be the Sicilians and Italians that came over here, and kind of went against the system. They don't pay taxes. They do whatever they want. They live a lifestyle that many of us would like to live, and they take the gamble and they go out and do it.
Yeah. So what's the Omaha in the Time of Saints is the original story, and I believe it deals with the Vatican, and it's set in the 1960s and describes a little bit about John F. Kennedy's administration, connections Vatican, and assassination, and it's a perfect blend of things. Wild Indians picks us up after that, and what I'd like to do is ask you, what's the origin of the name Wild Indians?
Okay, well, in the book, I'm giving some stuff away. The New York families back east, and I give them different names than the families that actually existed because some of those guys are still around. What they did, they called the Midwest families Wild Indians because they all came from cities that had Native American names, Milwaukee, Omaha, Kansas, Chicago, and they even threw Cleveland there because some guy thought, well, Cleveland, you heard of Cleveland Indians, right? And they go, yeah, okay, so that obviously got to be an Indian name.
So no Indians in the book.
No, there's no Native Americans in the book whatsoever.
And I should add just a quick thing, Bruce. The Milwaukee Braves also were also part of that. I'm sure they were part of that thought process.
How could I miss that? Thank you, Sylvia.
Yeah. Well, they're down. They're actually the Atlanta Braves right now. But at one time, when many of these mafia people were putting it together, they were the Milwaukee Braves. So that had to be part of their calculus, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I thought was kind of amusing. And I have to say, I've read most of your book as of today. It was really great summer reading. Your opening, I read Mario Puzo's Godfather, and I thought it was one of the most engrossing books I have ever read. And your opening sequence was on the same level, which leads me to ask, you refer to it as the Great Plains Bowling Massacre, and I won't reveal too much except to say it involves a hit. It's dramatically described. You see it coming, but you don't see the magnitude of it coming. And it was really, it was turned the page reading for me. Is that based on a true story? Is that something that you kind of made up?
Okay. Let's start with the whole basis of the books. My books have characters I create in fictional circumstances that interact with real historical events and a lot of trivia. I throw a lot of trivia in the books, too. That particular massacre, mob hit, as you would say, actually took place in another Midwest city, but I just moved I moved it to Omaha, to that bowling alley. The bowling alley actually was called the Ranch Bowl. And when I was a little kid, my parents used to bowl on a bowling league. And the description of all the different teams is actually true, what I remember as a kid, even down to the little cocktail glasses interwoven into the carpet. I described that.
Yeah, because that was a lot of detail, and that's one of the things I was, really caught up in, is that I could feel myself being there and just shocked at the magnitude of the operation and how the rival mafia group responded. And I won't give it away except to say it was satisfying. You go in a little bit on the Irish versus the Italian mafia, and I'm not versed in mafia lore. What were the big differences between the Irish and Italian mafia?
Mostly turf and who claimed they were there first. Actually, the Irish were here before the Italians as far as organized crime. And it goes back to New York, Harlem, areas of New York. And then they moved west. They migrated west. Omaha was the place that many Italians and Sicilians landed, along with the Irish. The Irish were actually into organized crime in Omaha first, but then when the Sicilians and Italians moved out, they were better organized, they had more people, and they could muscle. Other towns like Chicago and obviously Boston, where Whitey Bulger's on trial right now, where they were close to where their families landed, they stayed there. That's where they had their power. If you ever saw the movie The Departed, a Scorsese film, came out, 2006, 2005, really good chronicling of how that Irish organized crime family grew. Omaha had lesser, smaller, as all the Midwest cities did, but they controlled major factions of industry, or like stockyards. The Smaldones in Denver ran had a piece of the Pueblo steel mills, things like that, and they all kicked back to the guys back east.
Fascinating. If you could do you think the mafia is still that kind of presence, or do you think it has evolved into more of gangland style, like something out of Chicago, let's say?
If you continue with the book, there's a part in the book where they're going to pull their street presence off because they understand the competition is, other groups, ethnic groups are seeing this and seeing what the street crime can get them. They're going to pull their street presence off and get into more corporate banking and global enterprises.
And is that the direction that the real mafia has taken?
Actually, just 2 weeks ago in Sicily, they busted a bunch of, I don't know which family it was. It wasn't Ingrangheta, but guys that had manipulated the green industry globally and how people were buying all these green products and environmentally sound products and stuff. And most of it was just a scam run by Sicilian and Italian mafia families.
I hope they told Al Gore about that.
Yeah, I'm sure he's getting his kickbacks.
Well, that actually may explain a lot of the current administration's energy policy. One of the things about Oma and the Time of Saints that you mentioned, what involved the Vatican, and what you're tying with the Vatican in that book, or what's the feature there?
Okay, the thing that brought us to the Vatican and Omaha and the Time of Saints is in that book, one of the Omaha mob guys actually accidentally comes upon a declaration that a number of Air Force guys and scientists and theologists had written how early contact with UFOs, aliens from another planet, early in the mankind's history had shaped all religions. And this is just some guy's theory, right? And they were going to present it to John F. Kennedy and say, you've got to release this and let people know about these encounters with UFOs. Because, you know, World War II pilots talked about it. I'm sure you guys have read the history on that. And so the Don of the Italian, or the Omaha mob at that time, Don Fracicreta, wanted to keep the declaration secret, not release it to the president. And he starts whacking these guys that are in possession of it until he gets the declaration, and the threat to the Vatican and Catholicism, religions worldwide, is wiped out. And the Vatican's got a head guy on these guys, too. The Vatican put their own guy out there, too.
So, yeah, it's an amazing piece of fiction. And Bo, I'm sure that I didn't read the first book because I caught you discovering that you had just released Wild Indians. Is this self-published?
Yeah, I did it on CreateSpace because the books are really lousy and know that no publishers would pick them up, so I did it on CreateSpace.
Yeah. Well, that's the way I did mine, Bruce. I wrote a book earlier this year, published a book earlier this year, and I did it on CreateSpace too. It's very rewarding, isn't it, Bruce, to write a book? I mean, when it's a lot of work, I know, but when it's over and you hold it in your hand, it does make you feel good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. I enjoyed it. But since I did it myself, probably like you too, Sylvia, is that people come out of the woodwork and want a piece of this action. And like I was telling Leslie, I think in a Facebook message, you know, I could drill a lot of holes in the desert to get rid of these guys because, you know, they just don't stop. Everyone wants a piece of your stuff, and it ain't just, you know, it ain't going to happen.
Right. Well, I just told, you know, I remember when I published the book that I made a public announcement that only three people were going to get a free copy. My parents, my good friend Nestor, who I've known for a long time, and I gave Leslie a copy because Leslie has done such a wonderful job helping me with the show that I said, my executive producer's got to get one.
Yeah, and I, you know, now I must admit, I did buy Bruce's on Kindle. It was 99, and the best 99 cents I've spent.
Right.
Again, it was a really engaging summer read. And do you have another book in store in you, Bruce, or is this the last chapter?
There's always another book. You know, so
Bruce, can I ask you a question about?
Yeah. Well,
go ahead and answer Leslie, because I had another quick question for you.
Well, basically, the third book, when I get it done in a couple of years, we'll probably take the Fracicreta crime family into the future, maybe to the present.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking about when you were talking about these families. And when Leslie was asking you the question about, you know, the getting into banking and all that kind of stuff, and I thought to myself, I think it would be a wonderful segment if we could do a segment sometime later, Leslie and Bruce, about the similarities of these organizations with the cartels, you know, the drug cartels and how they operate. Because it seems to me they're very similar, aren't they, Bruce? I mean, the cartels are into all kinds of businesses. They have all kinds of fronts. to move their stuff. They're also, I mean, there's a lot of MBAs who work for the cartels because they hire very smart people to move money around. So there's got to be some similarities, and I like to think that maybe we can do a segment sometime on that, Bruce.
Okay, let me put that on my things to do list. You know, because I have a pretty good knowledge of how those guys work, cartels, not only in Mexico but other areas too.
Well, I would have to think the business, I mean, the business is very similar because you're basically operating outside the law and you're trying to operate outside the law. But at the same time, you know, you want to be legal. You know what I mean? There's this conflict between the illegal and the legal.
Well, basically, I think the difference between, like in the United States, the mafia and say, the government is the government collects taxes. The mafia doesn't pay taxes. There's not, other than that, there's not much difference between this. Between the two. That's my opinion.
It always comes down to the taxes, my friends.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, that's anything else about the books? Did I leave anything out? The history part of them, the factual history, it was fun. I learned a lot of stuff I thought I knew about stuff in research.
I did have one other
question.
Yeah, I did have one other question. Was the hit on the rock star based on reality, or is that just a fantasy you have based on your own musical experience?
That's a fantasy.
Okay. Because, you know, I envision sort of Bob Dylan, and if I could have put a hit on Bob Dylan, I totally would have. So I must admit I really enjoyed that chapter, and I read the paragraph or two again. So thank you for such an entertaining book. And I think my final question is, since we are hoping maybe this gets made into a movie and you reap lots of profits from it, because that's my gig, what's your favorite mafia-based movie, if you could pick one?
The Godfather.
The first one. As is mine. It's hard to beat. That's such a classic.
Yeah,
that is a good one.
That would be Goodfellas and Casino.
Yeah. Is there a scene in The Godfather you found especially, is one you remember most or one that you really like?
I think the transition for Michael when Don Corleone is in that closet in the hospital, they're trying to hide him from what they think is a hit, and it's actually the baker. And there's that moment where Michael holds Don Corleone's hand, you know, and he says, "I'm with you now, Pop." That's a very powerful scene. That's the transition of Michael Corleone. And then we see that character develop, very artfully done, very powerful.
Yes, that's a great scene. I agree totally with you. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And we got to bring you back, Leslie. We got to do another segment of this. This is really fascinating. The next time, we'll bring you in for the whole show. How's that?
Hey, that'd be great. Hey, thanks for having me on, Leslie. Thanks, Silvio. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Right. It was really absolutely wonderful. Great selection, Leslie. I think this was really, really a good show tonight. Well, next week, we're running out of time here, but just give me a heads up about next week.
Well, my compatriot, College Insurrection, Alistair, is going to be on for a second time, a reprise, and we'll be covering what's hot in the world of colleges, getting ready for the start of another academic year, and you know, covering items that he and I have been working on for the summer. There's been a lot. The colleges have not gone quiet. And as I mentioned before, the Title IX issues related to sexual harassment are one of many that have hit the internet. So looking forward to sharing the current events and news on the universities with you next week. And following week, I have Ladies Night with Mandy Nagy of Legal Insurrection, and she and I will be also be covering current events, but from the legal point of view. And she's really savvy on technology and personal security on the internet. So we're going to be great having her.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Leslie, so much for helping us out on Thursday night. Absolutely wonderful work tonight. Great guests, great conversation. And again, just thank you so much for what you do on Thursday nights. Absolutely fabulous. And you have a great evening and a great weekend with your family, and we're counting down to next Thursday night.
Yes, and thanks to listeners for supporting another author, and thank you for getting a platform for people who do some really amazing work. And you're the best, Sylvia. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much, Leslie. And we're going to leave the audience tonight with one of your favorite songs. This is The Sands of Egypt. I always enjoy playing this one when you're on. Good night, Leslie.
Good night, Sylvia.
Well, that's going to do it, folks. Thank you so much for listening to us tonight. We will come back next Thursday night with another great show with Leslie and her friends. Good night, everybody.